another. Tyndall kept up with me on his way toward the worm. Rondal got separated, and stuck next to Sire Kay and Sir Festaren, so we did our damnedest to distract the Hobbs from their task. Combat magic is tricky to use when friend and foe are so well mixed, but there were still plenty of spells to choose from. Pain, weakness, nausea, blindness, sleep, fear. I used it all. When we were truly in the thick of battle, behind the foe's shield wall and causing real damage, I dropped my sense of restraint and started using more wide-area spells. A few dozen fell to their knees, unable to breathe. Diaphragm stunning spell. Another knot of them burst into flames when Tyndall cast something nasty from his warstaff. At one point, I drew Twilight just to give me more options, and began cutting my way through the center of their ranks before returning the mage blade to its scabbard. I don't know how long I fought, or who was around me, beyond a certain point. My existence was confined to the goblin in front of me and the one I would kill after that. I hacked and dismembered with my glaive until things got too close, then switched to a spearhead. Blizzard was like a dream in my hand. Stab, point, blast, parry, turn, stab, repeat. I used physical augmentations lavishly, expending power to keep me moving much faster than my enemies. It also helped that I attacked most of them blindsided. The infantry was doing a good job keeping the goblins focused on them, so we war magi had an unfair advantage, and we used it. It doesn't take much to stab a goblin under the arm or through the neck when they don't see you coming. We chewed into that right flank like a troll with a bag full of kittens, and we didn't slow down until we could see the fronts of the shields of the infantry. That's when things got really interesting. Someone had finally unlimbered the disassembled siege engine components from the backs of the two worms, and now each was being led into battle by a team of three trolls, tugging at the chains that pierced their noses. While they had not been fitted for the portable redoubts that Tyndall and Rondal had spoken of, that massive horn and those gaping jaws made it formidable enough without it. The goblins cheered as the beasts were being led into the fray, even as they were being slaughtered by steel and spell. The worms were clearly hard to control. The trolls struggled mightily with the things, who clearly did not want to be led into conflict. "Tyndall!" I called out, mind to mind. "I believe the one on the left is yours. Stir him up!" "Yes, master!" he promised mentally. I don't know where he was in the battle, but soon the beast on the left was bucking its head wildly. Meanwhile, I found Rondal in the battle, protecting Sire Kay's back with Sir Festaren as the Dragon Slayer was carving his own way through the foe. He had yet to draw his hammer, depending instead on the cavalry sword every knight carried, along with his broad dragon-hide great shield. He looked grimly serene in the action. His mustache was curled with concentration as he felled one goblin after another. A few would attempt his flanks, but Sir Festaren's stalwart blade or Rondal's warstaff would intercept, followed by a brutal follow-through. "Rondal!" I called through the din. He didn't look up. "Striker!" I said, remembering his war name. Those who have been through the mysteries of Huin oftentimes respond better to that in the heat of battle, I'd noted. My apprentice looked up. "Your date for the ball is here," I said, indicating the worm to the right. "That could be deadly. Make it useless!" "Master?" Rondal breathed, studying the problem. The worm reached out and bit an infantryman in half, tugging at its trollish handler like an oversized dog leashed to a small boy. Rondal took a deep breath and let it out. "All right," he finally said. "This will take a moment." As he lumbered off through the battle, sprinting in zigzags with augmented speed, Sire Kay raised his visor and watched him go. "Are you certain that is not too much responsibility for one boy?" he asked. "He's a man now," I responded. "They both are. They aren't alone, and they've faced one before." "You have a lot of faith in your apprentices," Lorcus said, coming to rest beside us. There was a lull in this part of the battlefield, and I'd learned long ago to take advantage of such respites. I uncorked my water bottle and upended it. "They justify my faith," I said. "Usually. I just want them to irritate the worms enough so they aren't controllable." Sire Kay looked at me skeptically. "You think the key to winning the battle is to drive the foe's greatest weapon into a killing rage?" There are a lot more of them that stand to be killed than us, I pointed out. Remember what happened when the dragon fell at Cambrian? Vividly, Sayaka said, his face stone. I shut up. That was likely a tender memory, I realized. Well, if we can deprive the goblins of their heavy cavalry and make them more of a worry for them than us, I count that as a win. Besides, I said, glancing at the sun overhead, we're running out of time. Sayaka nodded. Lorcus looked amused. Sir Festaren looked aghast. And what, pray the gods, do we do once the beasts are rioting? Asked Sayaka. Why, that's where our dragon slayer comes in, Lorcus said with a wicked chuckle. He sipped on his bottle, too, but I could tell by the fumes that it wasn't water. That bloody big hammer of yours, I'm guessing. Right, men? Right, I agreed, at least as our first line of attack. I'm guessing that as strong and powerful as those things are, if you hit it hard enough, it's going to fall. Your secret plan, Sayaka reasoned, is me? One of them, I corrected. You're the first line of attack. We have others, myself included. A lot of us have been working on anti-dragon combat spells. This looks like an excellent opportunity to test some out. I'm so proud to be able to contribute to your research, Sayaka said sarcastically. Mage Lord, it occurs to me that attacking one of those things will likely attract the other, which is why I sent both apprentices. If both are busy with those irritants, then they won't be able to come to each other's aid. Sir Festaren, how many enemy left fighting? It took the young magical savant a moment to look around and survey the carnage. 6,788 goblins, 9 trolls, and 2 worms, he reported a moment later. I had no way of verifying that number, but thus far the knight's magical talent had been accurate. I still had no idea how it worked, thaumaturgically speaking, and I had yet to see anything similar in the literature. But I was relying on it now. And how many of our forces? 3,206 infantry, he reported instantly. 44 cavalry and 108 war magi. 107, he corrected, as someone somewhere died. We enrage the worms, let them roll around, get the goblins to back away from them, and we'll deal with them, I counseled. Who's going to deal with the bloody goblins? Asked Lorcus with a guffaw. One thing at a time, I promised. To emphasize my point, the left-hand worm started moaning pitifully and shaking its head wildly back and forth. The 3 trolls, struggling with the beast, went flying. As I predicted, the worm's exertions proved deadlier to its friends than its foes. In moments, goblins were fleeing from it in all directions, those who were lucky enough to escape its trampling feet. Tyndall, try to drive it toward the east side of the field, I ordered mind to mind. It took him a moment to get back to me. I'm trying, master. He's stubborn. A few moments later, however, the beast took a few lumbering steps through the goblin infantry in a generally eastwardly direction. Good boy. Rondol's worm, on the other hand, sat down on its hind legs and was refusing to move. Instead, it reared up on its back 2 sets of legs and howled painfully. I wasn't sure what the boy was doing to it, but it was effective. As I watched, Draenus reached me, mind to mind. He was attached to the Alka Alon and providing observation. Mage Lord, there seems to be some activity in the north, he dutifully reported. That is where we suspect the goblin priests are. They're raising power. I'm uncertain what they plan on doing with it, but I'm guessing their intentions are harmful. Thanks for the warning, I replied, then turned to the rest of the men. A few more war magi who had run out of targets for the moment joined us. Bendenal and Alskart the Fair among them. I looked around and counted noses. 8 or 9. More than enough for my purposes. The worm bellowed in pain again, nearly silencing everything else in the battle. That's our cue, gentlemen, I said, returning my water bottle to my belt and summoning the boar spearhead on Blizzard. We kill the worms and then destroy that stinking nest of evil the priests are putting together on the other side. Last one to the top of the rise buys the rest of us wine tonight. Chapter 26 The Icy Road. The chaos around the 2 suffering siege worms was bloody. Everywhere they stepped, the beasts seemed to crush the Gavani, desperately trying either to control them or flee for their lives. The trolls were looking frightened. If you've never seen a frightened 12-foot-tall troll panic like a little girl, it's an experience best viewed from a distance. As for me, I ignored their fragile mental states and stabbed the first troll I came to in the back of the knee with 18 inches of razor-sharp steel. The crossguard kept the blade from getting caught as the brute dropped to one knee and howled in pain. With a word, I banished the boar spear. With another, I summoned the poleaxe, and I buried the blade 5 inches deep in its neck. Trolls have very thick skin and tough bones, but 5 inches was enough to sever its spinal cord.
"Well struck,"
Lorca said with a grin, as he whizzed by me to confront the next troll. He stabbed the wand from his belt into its left elbow, and it screamed in pain. While its mouth was open, he jammed his mage blade through its roof, point first, and twisted. The troll's eyes widened and then lost all signs of life.
"I had expected that to be more difficult," Lorca said disapprovingly, as he yanked the sword free of the fallen corpse.
He had more difficulty doing that than he had slaying it.
"I do hope the worms are more challenging." "Let's find out," Onranian said suddenly, springing into action with that ridiculously long greatsword.
He impaled a Gavan, stepped aside and cut two more in twain at the waist, and kicked a fourth in the face before impaling it through the chest. He did it all with the grace and fluidity of a swordmaster.
"I had no idea that warfare was this much fun," he laughed, as he came to a rest with perfect form.
The area around the head of the left-hand beast was clearing out, save for the dead and dying. The worm itself was still moaning and trying to dislodge something from its head. Less than 50 yards away, I could smell its strong, foul odor.
"That one first," I breathed. "Sayake, if you will."
My castellan nodded and pulled his visor down. He sheathed his sword and pulled his warhammer from his belt. Then he brought the great dragon-hide war shield into guard, took a deep breath, and began marching resolutely toward the beast.
"Fall in behind," I ordered,
summoning my halberd and taking a position behind Kay's left shoulder. Lorcas fell in on his right. We marched in a rough wedge, dispatching individual goblins we came across as we crossed the field. Sayake waited until the mewling beast's head waved slowly and painfully into his direction. The great creature stared at him with tiny, confused eyes, its massive lips curled back in irritation. If it sensed Kay was a threat, it didn't show it. The dragon slayer took another deep breath and wound up his hammer. I could feel the surge of magical energy as he summoned the emotion needed to trigger his special ability. Just like in training, the moment the head of his meteoric iron hammer impacted on the side of the worm's head, a concussive wave of force exploded from it. You could see the shock wave ripple through the massive head. The great, heavily muscled neck flopped instantly to the side at an unnatural angle, and the rigid bones of the skull were shattered. With a final mournful moan, the great head fell to the ground, the legs lifelessly following suit a moment later. There was a stunned silence on the battlefield for a split second. Then the chaos resumed, accompanied by a chorus of despair from the Gavani. Before we could turn our attention to the second beast, it too faced defeat. Onranian had crossed the field again and had tried to attack its head, as Sayake had done. Lacking the dragon slayer's weapon or ability, his great sword deflected harmlessly off of the beast's nose horn, and a flick of its head sent the Alka'alon lord flying. But then Terlaman and his guards waded into the fray. The commander looked dour as he prepared a spell, borrowing power and support from his fellows in the magical corps until he had a good position. Then he activated it. The siege worm was suddenly engulfed in a blue hot flame from nose horn to tail. Dragons may be highly resistant to fire, but drakes are less so. This magical fire burned it to a hulking corpse in seconds, sending a column of dark, evil-looking smoke into the sky.
"Well cast!" Lorcas called out excitedly. "Huon's hairy hams, that's a war mage!"
I couldn't disagree. Oranian was less pleased. He'd been hoping to kill the worm himself, and had to console himself with slaughtering the trolls who tried to interfere with the blazing drake. I couldn't fault his skill or his enthusiasm, but when he wasn't being as delightfully charming as a Gilmoran dandy, Onranyan was irritating as hell to fight next to.
"Two worms down," Lorcas pointed out. "What now, my liege?" "Sir Festaren," I called. "Goblin count?"
6,109. I looked around. The shamans were still muttering their spells on the north side of their formation. That was the next biggest threat. The infantry had spread out and contained the bulk of the hobgoblins and Gavani light infantry, but the priests could turn that around if we allowed them to work uninterrupted. "The priests," I called out, "magical corps, rally on me, focus on the priests, stop the spells." The word was taken up and passed around enthusiastically. Tyndall and Rondal limped back to our position. Sayake finished off his water bottle and most of Rondal's while we waited. It didn't take long. Before he handed the empty bottle back, we had more than a score of men, Terlaman and Aranyan included.
"What about the Alcan archers, Mage Lord?" asked Terl when he arrived. "They're sitting back, doing nothing right now."
"Use them to flank," suggested Lorcas. "The infantry has them pinned on the south side. If we destroy their priests, they'll be defeated. Have the archers move around to the east and come up the rise from there. Get close and volley them to death." A moment's mind-to-mind link with Draenus and they were on the way. "That means we need to hit them first and drive them into a nice, easy-to-shoot density. They're guarded by hobs," I noted, confirming it with mage sight. "But if we're determined, we can get to them before they unleash whatever naughtiness they're planning. Everyone prepared for a charge?" I asked. There were nods and grins and several war magi who hurriedly did what they needed to prepare. There were a few walking wounded I excused from the battle. I sent them to join the Alka Alana's reserves if we got into trouble. I didn't want to get into trouble. The priests were in a kind of makeshift redoubt, comprised of the disassembled pieces of siege engines, baggage, stores, rations, supplies, and whatever else goblins like taking to a siege. The encampment was at the top of a low ridge on the north side of the field, toward the river. There were a few thousand goblins between us and them, including the largest of the hobgoblins, a pack of fellhound riders, and the last of their trolls. It was hard to see them at that distance, through gloom and smoke, but they were chanting, and they were raising power. The bastards had picked up enough imperial techniques to start working together, as I'd learned in the penumbra. I didn't know a lot about Gavani magic, but some things are universal, like not having your spell casting interrupted before it's completed. All sorts of bad things could happen that way.
"Tara," I called, mind to mind, "arm yourself with those glass globes we brought. It's time you and your wing made a proper appearance in battle. I want you to attack the center and target the trolls especially."
"Yes, master," she replied excitedly.
She was back at the castle, but one advantage of having air cavalry is their speed. Just as we were preparing our advance, I saw a shadow fly over the goblins, blocking them momentarily from the noonday sun. Then a flight of four giant falcons streaked downward toward the encampment in a surprisingly straight line. One by one, the diminutive riders hurled their missiles at the big hulking monsters standing around the center of the camp. Out of four tries, three hit. The third broke against the head of a particularly large and stupid-looking hobgoblin guard. The tiny glass spheres shattered harmlessly against the rough hides of the trolls. Then the two trolls, and the hobgoblin, went berserk, attacking everything in sight with no regard to their own safety. That put a damper on their spell work. In moments, the three combatants mindlessly hewed at their comrades, the trolls picking up Gavani-like toys and tossing them around. Several shamans were abused that way by one troll in particular, while the other thundered against the guards. For good measure, the great birds wheeled around and made a second approach, adding more insanity to the fray with more berserker balls. Taran had had those made from an old spell, dating from the magocracy he discovered among the proscribed records the censorate kept in Wenshar. They were insidious little things. They allowed one to turn an enemy's strength against him in battle. They also weighed very little, which made them excellent aerial missiles for the Skyriders.
Their deployment hampered the goblin's spell and made organizing a defense from a suddenly aggressive band of war magi a challenge. I glanced at the sun again. It shouldn't be long now.
Let's go start the cleanup. Telemann, would you have the honor of leading us in a charge?
It would be my pleasure, he said, taking a stand between Sayake and Bendanar the Outlaw.
Form up on me. We go straight in. We've no allies in the area, so you don't have to worry about friendly casualties. Don't restrain yourselves on account of being in cultured Gilmora, gentlemen, he barked, eliciting a laugh from the crowd as we made ready again.
Rondal, surprisingly, stood behind him and raised his warstaff. With a whisper, the pole extended by a third and produced the Sevendor snowflake banner, white on green. There was a ragged cheer from Tyndall, Kay, and the others from my little land.
Charge!
Telemann said, drawing his sword and leading the way. An infantry charge is a lot different than a cavalry charge. The principle was the same. Move in formation and accelerate to the point where your combined mass added to the damage and devastation of your impact. With a cavalry charge, you have to pay particular attention to the mounts on either side and behind you, as well as be mindful of your own mount's health and disposition. It's nerve-wracking, and one sullen nag in the line can ruin the effectiveness of the charge. But an infantry charge, though smaller in mass, allows a man to concentrate on the matter-of-fact business of fighting for his life. Honestly, a horse in battle is a great advantage, but it has some powerful disadvantages too. It can attract an attack meant for you, but it can also fall on your leg and leave you helpless on the field. As we rushed toward the ragged edge of light infantry that was becoming aware of our attack, I tried to appreciate the intimate nature of the infantry charge, while I avoided the pitfalls. This time most of us focused on magical attacks, rather than hand-to-hand combat. Without having to worry about allies, we could use the really nasty spells. Explosions and implosions, lightning and fire lanced out ahead of us and thinned the Gavani line before we arrived. Bodies blew high in the air or fell on their faces, stricken by ailments and injuries. A great swath of eunuchs suddenly began crying in alarm as their eyesight failed. A wall of flame erupted on our far right as some mage, Lorcus, I think, cut loose with a variety of incendiary spells. Our actual charge against the ragged line of shields that stood in defense of the camp was more like crumpling a piece of parchment than slamming a book shut. With Sayake at the point of our van, swinging his hammer and sending dozens of Gavani into the afterlife with every swing, picking through the survivors was easy. A single blow would destroy even a bronze shield and demolish whatever arm chanced to hold it. Mage blades and other weapons flashed faster than the eye could see, while concussive blasts and magical lightning brightened the afternoon. It was remarkable how quickly we cleared a path. Those too close to us had suffered direly, and those near to them were right to be fearful. We dodged plenty of arrows at that range, but there were few who were willing to rush through the tangled crowd of disabled survivors to see what we had in store for them next. I didn't know about the other magi, but I had plenty of war spells left to try in my arsenal. We were within 40 feet of the barricades that protected the camp, still pushing forward behind Kay, when Dara and her wing made another appearance. This time we were close enough to see them in action. The priests were aware of them too, and dozens of arrows were launched ineffectively at the birds. This time the wing did not lob magic balls at them. A series of javelins was hurled from the avian saddles instead. These were the sky bolts she had been so excited about. Short, fletched javelins, designed for throwing from hawkback against ground targets. Her wing had been practicing with them on the slopes of Matten's Helm all winter long. They had gotten good. Two of the four spikes from the sky found their mark amongst the black-robed priests of Sherul. To add insult to injury, each hawk extended its mighty talons to grasp whatever Gavani it could find purchase on, before heading skyward again. A few seconds, and 100 feet in the air later, they would plummet helplessly to earth. Tyndall and Rondal were cheering their fellow apprentice's bold strike. Telemann looked skyward, squinting as he summoned mage sight.
I had not met your Skyriders, men, and I know your apprentice is their leader, but are those Tal-Alon riding them? He asked in disbelief.
Yes,
I nodded. Two of them. Dara had a hard time finding human riders light enough and brave enough to learn how to ride, I explained. Surprisingly, a few of the Tal of Holly Burrow were game. She's been practicing with them constantly since the magic fair.
Amazing, he said, shaking his head.
They're usually so timid, such useless creatures in a fight. But that was admirably done, he said, nodding to the graceful shapes climbing again. I puffed a little about that. I had had little to do with the program, but Dara and Ithalia had put together a powerful little unit that had gained notice. This experiment certainly merited expanding. I was about to continue the charge, now that we'd caught our breath, when Telemann held up his hand. Hold! He called out, making the hand signal.
Why?
I asked, confused. We were so close. One more push and we'd be at the barricade. I got my answer before Telemann could speak. Hundreds of white-shafted, white-fletched arrows sang overhead and broke on the camp like an ocean wave. Another was in the sky a moment later, and before my heart could beat 10 more times, a third rained down on the Givani Center.
Now we can attack,
Telemann assured. Sir Festaren blew the call while Rundle re-established the banner. He'd had to turn it into a spear for a few minutes. The final push to the barricade and then storming the makeshift redoubt was professionally satisfying. After the triple volley from the Alka'alon, the defenders of the camp were dazed and wounded and unorganized. One of the berserk trolls was still thundering around, slaying everything it could while its former comrades tried their best to subdue it. While individual Givani and hobgoblins were desperately putting up a fight, many we slew were already wounded or so confused by the attacks from the sky that we merely dispatched them. The priests fought. They were the representatives of the old god, he who did not tolerate failure. They fought with magic and blade, club and knife, and with bare claws when cornered. But they were overmatched. Individually, they were rarely better fighters than infantry, and even their combat spells were sluggish compared to ours. It took some effort, but 15 minutes after 20 of us came over the barricade, not a priest was left alive within. The battle was not over, of course.
Fess, how many goblins now?
A moment later he answered.
4,018, Mage Lord.
He sounded weary.
We're in position and ready, Mage Lord,
Furundal of Robinwing, the Mage Lord who commanded the cavalry, reported to me mind to mind.
Watch this, gentlemen,
I suggested, as I mounted the barricade. Yes, it was a bit dangerous, but honestly the goblins weren't paying us much attention anymore. Once it was clear their camp had been overrun, they began to break and join the troops engaged with the infantry, or just ran away. Through the trees at the bottom of the rise, off to the west, came a rumbling, and 1,000 knights and men-at-arms from Castle Gavard galloped onto the field, lances couched in a blunt wedge formation. They walked their horses out of the tree line, formed up, and charged across the field against the exposed right flank of the foe in mere minutes. They had spent the last 2 hours coming around by a circuitous route to descend from the other direction, and happened to be well placed to affect the outcome of the battle. The charge was powerful. Three ranks of heavy cavalry ploughed into the Givani-like moist turf, their lances flashing in the afternoon sun. The infantry hesitated while their comrades did their work, and then redoubled their attack on the force that remained standing.
How many now, Fess?
I asked tiredly.
2,000? 2,426, Mage Lord, he reported, give or take.
Gentlemen, I'm going to declare victory, I decided. Let's mop up this mess and get back to the castle to see where else we're needed.
Of course, it wasn't that simple. Many of the surviving Givani broke and fled, leaving their swords and shields behind them. A few intact units peeled away before we could catch them, and the damned fellhounds proved elusive. Still, at the end of the day, there were at least 8,000 fewer goblins in the world than at the dawn. Our own casualties were less than 1,000, mostly infantry. We established an aid station at the castle, and a field hospital for the most severely injured. Those who could be moved, we piled into wains and had them escorted south to Pentandra's command, where they could be properly tended. All in all, the Battle of the Noonday Sun was remarkable, mostly because of the large number of high war magi who were involved, the most in any engagement of the war to date. After the battle, I was able to make 11 more high magi from the stones we recovered from the dead at the camp, and, alas, 4 more from the war magi who had fallen in battle. None of them were friends of mine, which was a relief, but it was a blow nonetheless. The urge to feast and celebrate our victory was strong, but we confined it to a single toast at an assembly after dark. We had plenty of Kasari scouts and war magi patrolling our periphery, and while the long stream of goblins continued to pour in from the north, few of them seemed willing to attack us for some reason. I could not let the event stand unrecognized, however. I had 3 barrels of wine brought up from stores, and we toasted the puissance of the Dragon Slayer, the adept flying of the Hawk Maiden and her squadron, the accuracy of the Alka Alon archers, the bravery of the infantry, and the gallantry of the cavalry. I also praised Terlaman's command. We had struck a good blow against Shirul today. But the truth was streaming past our window. Goblins still ruled northern Gilmora, and they were pushing south, east, and west. Today was a victory, and one that deserved celebration, but we were exhausted and there was still much to be done. I bid those not on immediate duty to get some rest. Then I thanked my commanders, headed back to my quarters, doffed my armor, and called to Alia by mirror to let her know everyone from Sevendor had survived the battle. She and the baby wished me good night, and I passed out cold on the bed, without even removing my bloodied boots. While the Baron of Gavard handled the clean-up after the battle, and the security for the castle, the rest of us tried to figure out just how badly the war was going. Our victory at Gavard was great, but it was the exception. I stumbled into the headquarters room the next day at mid-morning, having gulped the mug of beer and eaten a crust before I arrived. Lance of Boon was already there, going through the dispatches that had arrived in the night. Talaman had kept the information flowing throughout our entire battle, and even though Lance had taken a break to play the role of a combat war magi for the battle, he was back at his diorama at the first opportunity. I feared the worst when I stared at the 3-dimensional map he was fiddling with. After a few moments, I shook my head to see if I was still dreaming. "Is this accurate?" I demanded. The tall, lanky war mage shrugged and took a sip of the nauseating green mountain wine he drank day and night. "To the best of my ability," he offered. "Those are the reports that have come in. That is what they look like, once you play them out." But this can't be right, I said, confused. "There are not nearly enough goblins below the Poros." "Noticed that, did you?" he asked, his mouth cocked sardonically. "Problem is, their column hasn't stopped." "What?" "They've been marching south every second," he related, taking another sip. "Scouts north of the river report the last of their rear straggled past them about dawn." "So, where are they?" I demanded angrily. "Don't get mad at me," Lance said, raising his hands. "I just wiggle the dolls. That's what the reports are telling us," he said with emphasis. "The goblins marched south, and all of those miles and miles of legions didn't cross the Poros." "Then where the hell are they?" I repeated. "I don't know," he answered, throwing his hands up in the air. "They aren't anywhere south of here. Not many of them anyway. The rest... poof," he said, snapping. That can't be right," I said, shaking my head. "Where's Terl?" "Right here," the commander said, stepping up behind me. "I've been up since dawn. I didn't believe it either, but I went down to the river. That column used our drawbridge as a ramp right down onto the river, but they didn't climb up the other side."
"Then where did they go?"
"Up river," he supplied. "The majority of them, anyway. A much smaller force went in the opposite direction, but most of them, over 100,000, went west, not east."
"West? To where?"
I asked, my mind racing. He led me over to the map table, where a large hide displaying the rough details of Gilmora was laid out. "Take your pick," he offered. "If they come out here, they can march through western Gilmora, split at the Arenstirath Hills, and invade the southern Castali Riverlands or southern Alshar with equal ease. Or, he continued, they could ravage western Gilmora, move south and east, repeat their frozen river trick here, and march straight to Darkfaller, and then Castavriel, neatly bypassing the 60,000 troops we have protecting Gilmora from the north. Or, he continued grimly, moving his finger to the east, they can penetrate western Gilmora here and here, move through southern Gilmora, and take Barrowbell from behind. Or 100 other possible ways to send the kingdom into the chamberpot.
Gods! I hadn't even considered that, I said, my head spinning. I could feel my sphere bob uneasily behind me.
It sometimes reflected my emotions, if they weren't under control. The river as a road. They've turned our best asset against us. The heart of our economy is based on the river trade, and they just kept us from using it while being able to use it themselves.
But where are they going to emerge? He asked, deep in thought, as he studied the map. Any guess we make, based on what we would do, has to be wrong.
He reasoned, we just don't have enough information. I went through the belongings of the priests, searching for any intelligence. Sadly, the Gavani rarely committed orders to writing, so there was precious little to discern. Whatever their purpose in taking the icy road westward, we just won't know. Meanwhile, there are enough goblins still pushing through this hole they've left in Gilmora to keep us busy for a lifetime. The most advanced raiders are already pushing into the eastern baronies.
I saw. I agreed, gnawing my thumbnail.
Rad's not going to like that. I can't say I blame him. The local people there are prepared for that sort of thing after the last 2 years, but we can't really redeploy any of the forces in northern Gilmora without knowing where that damn column disappeared to. Do you know how many tributaries the Poros has?
Dozens. Each one leads to a lucrative barony, any one of which would make a wonderful spot to act as a staging area for pretty much whatever the hell Sherul wants to do with us.
I know, I said, thinking furiously.
What the hells were they after? A quick end to the war? Maximum casualties? Strategic advantage? The richest source of slaves and sacrifices?
Terlaman was correct. Whatever we might think we knew about Charul's plans, the only thing we were certain of was that we were wrong.
Who's going to explain this to Rad? He asked, clearly not relishing the duty, but willing to accept it.
Terlaman is an ideal soldier.
I'll do it, I decided. That's the unfortunate thing about power. There's always some asshole out there with a little more power that you have to explain yourself to.
It was my plan. It was my failure.
I'll report it.
Good gods, I hope you aren't going to report it that way, he said, concerned.
Min, there was no way of knowing that they'd do that. Our plan was sound.
The enemy just didn't cooperate.
I agreed. I know. But it was my plan. I'm responsible, not you. I'll take the friction involved. Besides, breaking bad news to the king is becoming something of a hobby of mine. I meant it as a weak joke. But it didn't go over well, as Terl was distracted by an officer bearing a dispatch through the mirror.
Talaman read it, and I watched as his brow furrowed deeply. He handed it to me when he was done.
Good, he replied, because you get to deliver a double dose. The watchers in the penumbra just reported to Megalyn Castle that they witnessed dragons leaving the Umbra on the southeastern side.
5 dragons, he said flatly, and they're headed south.
Chapter 27 Stuck in the Ice.
Dragons now? King Rad asked in disbelief.
His image was pale in the mirror, and his voice a little faint.
Has the goblins crossed the river with impunity, and now there are dragons in the air?
5?
That is what the reports say, Majesty, I confirmed gravely, and I'm not any happier about it than you are.
I thought you were working on spells to oppose them, he asked quickly.
We are. And we tested some yesterday. Good results.
but against a siege worm, not a dragon. Majesty, as big a problem as the dragons are, our more immediate concern is the main goblin army. While a force of 30,000 still encamps beyond the Porus, the majority are on the move.
Where to? Gilmora?
No. They used the frozen Porus as a road west. We know not where their destination lies. From what we've been able to speculate, they could employ it in any number of ways, none of them favorable to our position. But it did explain the need for iron shoes. The Gavani wouldn't have needed them simply to cross the Porus, but to march for an extended period of time on an icy river, they would be necessary. So much for hindsight.
But why move west when the bulk of the kingdom's resources lie to the east? He asked.
That's a very good question, Majesty. The honest answer is we don't know. Shadul is playing some game we can only guess at. We're good at guessing, but this situation is complex.
So what is the state of northern Gilmoran now?
He asked simply. The second commando was essentially destroyed. We're still finding remnants, but most were killed. The first and third are holding their areas and are countering the Gavani where they encounter them. The mercenary army has kept Barobel screened from attack, but several bands have slipped through our pickets and are raiding the eastern countryside. Their human confederate, the one known as Buckler, is leading a force of cavalry, horse cavalry, against select manors, from what we can tell. All told, there are likely another 20,000 to 30,000 goblins loose here, in addition to the slavers and raiders that were here before.
Against our 60,000 men, Rad countered. I like those odds.
If they would condescend to gather and face us in mass, Majesty, I would agree. But most of our strength is in camps or garrisons, concentrated. Theirs is diffuse. Our total numbers mean less than what we can muster for any particular engagement. With a few exceptions, they have avoided our strong points and are attacking our weakest ones.
A few hamlets and manors, he dismissed. Save for this mysterious vanishing army and the demise of the second commando, we seem to have lost little in this invasion.
He was trying to be hopeful. I suppose that was important for a head of state.
Yes, Majesty, I agreed, rather than try to defend the lives of the people in those hamlets and manors. We feel that if we can figure out where the army and the dragons have gone, we can redeploy to meet them, should we be able to prepare sufficient strength.
As to that, you know I've sent my son to take command of those reserves upriver from you, he commented. They are milling around without anything to do, hundreds of miles from the action. He was eager for some small part in the war, so I felt that leading those men to garrisons in Gilmora would be helpful.
Thank you, Your Majesty, I said, nodding. I'm sure his rank and position will help get them organized. We've heard little from them, save confusion about the Porus their barges were trapped upon. I'm certain they can be of more use elsewhere.
That was about as much involvement with military affairs as I wanted from the royal house. Of course, every high noble also fancied himself an adept military commander and inspiring war leader, but that was rarely the case. The prince heir was a fine gentleman, according to all social standards, but that did not make him a general. Leading the reserves was the limit of his military usefulness, particularly with his wedding scheduled in a few short weeks. If Castabriel wasn't under siege by then.
There is good news, Majesty. The alliance with the Alca Alon has proven fruitful. Never have I seen more deadly archery on the field, nor such skill with steel and spell. Should this alliance be cultivated, it could prove decisive, particularly in regard to dragons.
That is encouraging, he admitted. Mayhap these strange folk can devise a way to find that missing army. We discussed a few more matters of consequence, mostly regarding policy and strategy, before he bid me to keep working on the problem and close the mirror. The only good thing about being chewed out by the king, by mirror, was that the queen hadn't been there. I limped back to the tower room near my quarters that had been taken over by Lorcus and made into a kind of seven-dory embassy. That is, once he had hung a snowflake banner and procured a store of spirits and wine, that's where we went to drink and talk when the castle's ostentatious great hall was too far away, or too public.
Now that the immediate threat of the goblin army was an inky black stain on the horizon, as their bodies were burnt, there was more time to do so. And after that stark talk with Rad, I needed a drink. Unsurprisingly, Tyndall and Rondell were both there nursing ales, their eyes exhausted after yesterday's powerful exertions. Using magic on that level is physically draining, and war magic twice so. They were young, healthy boys. They would recover quickly. Lorcus didn't look fazed by the battle, save for around his eyes. He was drinking wine and eating an apple, alongside Sire Kay, who seemed equally undisturbed by battle, though I detected that he was moving a little gingerly. I was feeling pretty rugged myself. No matter how comfortable the armor, wear it for 6 hours straight, and you feel it. My muscles ached terribly. I sprawled in a chair next to the little trestled table and tried to relax. I was amongst friends, after all. Lorcus poured a glass of something and pushed it at me, and I drank. As the liquor burned a trail to my empty stomach, I sighed. "What the hells can we do?" I asked no one in particular. "Was that a simple cry of helplessness, or are you soliciting suggestions?" Lorcus asked, after a moment's silence. "Probably the former, but I wouldn't reject the latter," I decided, taking another drink. "I just informed the king of the situation. He is not happy. He should be bloody ecstatic that Gilmora got a sprinkle when he expected a flood," Lorcus snapped. "His relief is tempered by the bloody huge army that's wandering through his kingdom, and the 5 dragons that were seen emerging from the Umbra."
Five?
Rondell asked, worriedly.
"That's a lot of power," Tyndall said, his eyes wide. He had seen 1 dragon destroy a castle like a child picking apart a sandcastle. The prospect of 5 of the beasts was unimaginable to him. I empathized.
"We've only the 1 dragon slayer, Lorcus nodded, indicating Sire Kay. "We need more information," Sire Kay said, shaking his head. "Where is this army destined? Where are these dragons deployed? And do not forget the goblins encamped north of the river."
"They're covering the escape route," Lorcus suggested. "Reserves, mostly, I'd bet."
"They'd still take a lot of killing," Tyndall pointed out.
"The Kasari say that there are a lot more worms with them. They may even make another attempt on Gavard Castle."
"Only because we're here," Rondell said. "We present a tactical threat to them. This is where their ice spell was initiated."
"That's insightful," I admitted. "It makes sense that this enchantment takes a lot of power. If they had to rely on power from Sharul directly. The ice isn't just on the surface. Every bit of it is frozen, from the top to the depths. From here to hundreds of miles in both directions. Even trying to come up with the right formula for how much power that would take is beyond me. But it makes sense that they would need a local focus to channel that power. Some device or enchantment through which it is being maintained."
"Yes. That may well be why that reserve army is there. To protect the river enchantment." We discussed various ideas for what that enchantment would be, what it would look like, and how the power would have to be channeled to create the sustained icing effect. We were considering ways to go after the enchantment when we were joined by Dara, still in her fighting leathers, and apparently just back from patrol. She came in, threw her leather helmet and gloves on the table, poured a drink of spirits, drained it, and then poured another.
"I'm back," she said hoarsely. "I took the wing on patrol over the river, up as far as we could go. You can see where the goblins marched because the river is white before they come, and black afterward. They leave it scuffed and mired behind them. They're burning every village they can, on either side of the river, and they attacked a small town about 20 miles west of here."
"Marlarine," Lorcus supplied.
"They ruined the waterfront and savaged the town, and apparently some fell hounds were let loose on the countryside. But they didn't linger. They kept moving, and moving. Master, they're making at least 30 miles a day," she said, appalled. "They barely slowed down to raise that town."
"Were you able to see how far the ice enchantment spread?" Rondell asked.
"Along all the tributaries," my youngest apprentice said, as she flopped wearily onto a stool with her drink. "Everyone.
They keep sending small bands up them to raid and burn, but they're sticking to the Poros for now.
What the hells are they up to? I asked rhetorically.
Human civilization lies east. Why go west?
It was true that there were plenty of settlements west of Gilmora, but none had the population density that the Cottonlands did. There were only a few more cities of any size along the Poros to the west, and they grew smaller and less grand the more west you went. Eventually the Poros flowed through the Alshari Riverlands, and thence from the escarpment that leads to the Mindans and the Wilderlands proper.
Maybe they took a wrong turn, offered Lorcus. This is stratagem, not stupidity, Sire Kay said thoughtfully. The goblins made this campaign with great purpose, and put much thought into its execution. Despite our victory yesterday, it occurs to me that it was but a minor skirmish in a much greater design.
The key is the river, Rondol said, drumming his fingers absently on the table.
Why that river? Why now? Why the entire river and not just a section? I've been studying maps of this whole area, Tyndall agreed. Beyond Hounswell, there just isn't anything worth attacking. It's all freeholds, all the way to the escarpment, and Hounswell is a town of just 2,000 people.
We kicked around various ideas, from the practical. Shurul was after iron deposits in the Mindans, and wanted to take the scenic route to them, to the whimsical. Shurul had a mistress in Hounswell he was anxious to see. Lorcus contribution. But in the end we were just as mystified as in the beginning. Finally, Dara, whom I had forbidden a third glass of spirits, made an observation that haunted me.
What if we're looking at the wrong map?
She went on to discuss the possibility of there being a special reason the dragons were involved, that perhaps they needed to secure mating or nesting grounds. She'd been doing much the same with her giant falcons, and she was aware of the challenges involved with such large beasts. But her comment stuck with me, even if her reasoning did not.
What if we were using the wrong map?
The enchanted Alka Alon had agreed to encamp outside of the castle, since they found the interior unpleasant for more than a visit, and, to be honest, their presence was highly distracting to the rest of the garrison. Instead, they were persuaded to make a camp in a nearby wood, of course, near to the camp that the Kasari had set up. The Kasari camp was a textbook example of neatly ordered tents, cookfires, mess pavilions, and the like. The Alka Alon, on the other hand, had caused a thick brace of briars to grow up in a wide circle, a few hundred feet across, and had enchanted various trees to their command. Most of the beautiful humanoids were employed restocking their supply of human-sized arrows. They were in good spirits and, of course, singing the entire time. I took Captain Arborn with me, both for his familiarity with the Wilderlands and his knowledge of the Alka Alon. We found the unguarded entrance to the camp, and it didn't take long to find Master Onranian sitting under a rhododendron, sharpening his massive greatsword with a stone.
"A glorious commander," he greeted me, without rising. "What brings you by our humble thicket this afternoon?"
"To toast our victory," I said, indicating the full wineskin I'd brought along, "and to discuss its aftermath." He smacked his lips.
"Wine? You have my complete attention."
Onranian had become quite the connoisseur of wine since he had come to Sevendor, and seemed to have an endless capacity for it. He drained the small travelling cup I poured him, and had another before we could get to the meat of the matter. Arborn had one cup and nursed it the entire time. The Kasari weren't exactly against strong drink, but they were wary of its effects.
"The question remains where this goblin army is headed," Arborn began directly. "They have taken to the frozen Poros, and are headed westward."
"Westward?" Onranian asked, confused.
"Why, that doesn't make any sense."
"Precisely what we've been thinking," I agreed, sipping my own wine. "There are no great human cities there. Nothing but dirt farms, shallow mines, and woodsmen. The bulk of our strength lies in the east. He has the tools to really harm us. Why eschew a perfect opportunity to deal us a deadly blow?"
"Perhaps they took a wrong turn," Onranian provided unhelpfully.
It occurred to me that being a smartass transcended race and species.
The army has ignored every opportunity to leave the Poros and descend upon the human lands in strength. They've persisted in their march up the Poros, steadfastly. We were thinking that perhaps they were pursuing some objective we were unaware of, Arborn said diplomatically. What do the fair folk know of the lands in that region? Up the Poros? Wild, rugged country there. Asmadadalon, it was called of old. Land of scars. A wild and beautiful place, of course, but also a dangerous one. Beasts from before the Alon came to Calador still roam there. A savage land that attracts the savage among us. That's where Korbal arose. Korbal, I interrupted. The legendary mountain demon. That's how you Humani refer to him, the old Alcan laughed. That's so amusing. No, long before Humani inhabited those lands, an Alcan recluse by the name of Korbal retired to the Land of Scars to conduct experiments that were best done in secret. He worked for many years in that desolate place, under the very noses of the elders at Anthatiel and the Council. But, of course, eventually his experiments with prescribed magics came to be known. The elders tried to intervene quietly, but Korbal would not give up his studies. They sent embassies, and eventually they went against him in force. But he had been in the Land of Scars a long time, and he eluded capture for years. His minions made pursuit difficult. He was slain, it was said, a number of times, but he always returned to regroup his forces. Eventually he was captured and imprisoned deep in those same hills. Great spells of protection were laid to keep him from ever rising again, and the location is a secret. But it could be he seeks Korbal. What was Korbal's special field of research? I asked, thinking I already knew the answer. Transgenic enchantments. Why, no, Onranyan said curiously. Necromancy. That word hung like a pall over the conversation. No one likes necromancy. No one who has ever had to face it, that is. Bringing the dead back to unlife is not complicated, but it is morally repugnant. Of course, the disembodied floating head in the big ball of Irionite might have a different perspective on the subject. So Sherud could be searching for Korbal's tomb, Arborn prompted.
Onranyan laughed as he poured another cup.
That would be ludicrous. As I said, that tomb was concealed by the full power of the Alcaalon Council. An army would be of no use. One could scour those impassable lands for centuries and find no trace. The very thought is absurd. Why, an army that close
His face went slack, and his humanish eyes showed a feeling of panic, dread, and wonderment.
No. No! That's audacious, he said to himself.
What? I demanded.
Clarity, master, pleaded Arborn quietly.
The word seemed to affect the Alcan. He straightened and set his cup down, taking a deep, nostril flaring breath.
The reason that searching for Korbal's tomb with an army would be useless, besides its hidden nature, is the fact that beyond the Land of Scars, in the deep valleys of the Mindens, lies the powerful Alcaalon city on the lake. Anthatiel.
Anthatiel. The Tower of Vision on the Lake of Rainbows. The lake that feeds the Poros. The lake that stands as the ultimate defense of that ancient citadel in that remote region. The lake protected from even simple detection by the song spells at play in the ever-present rainbows that merrily dance above its spires. The lake that is now, no doubt, utterly frozen by Sherul's sorceries. He concluded, meaningfully. The pieces fell into place.
You don't need an army to discover Korbal's tomb, I reasoned, but you would need an army to assault an unassailable citadel. A big one.
An army so large, an army about as large as the one Sherul has gathered, Oranian said. his eyes wide in fear. An army outfitted with siege engines and great beasts to assault the gates, I agreed. An army provided with iron